Star Tide Rising, Cassette 7.
Chapter 45. Tom Worley. A chilly sea breeze swept over him out of the west. A bout of shivering shook him awake in the middle of the night, his eyes open in the dark, staring into emptiness. He couldn't remember where he was. Give it a moment, he thought. It'll come. He had been dreaming of the planet Garth, where the seas were small and the rivers many. There he had lived for a time among the human and chimp colonists, a mixed colony as rich and surprising as Calathea, where man and dolphin dwelt together. Garth was a friendly world, though isolated far from other Earthling settlements. In his dream, Garth was invaded. Giant warships hovered over her cities and spewed clouds of gas across her fertile valleys, sending colonists fleeing in panic. The sky had been filled with flashing lights. He had trouble separating the trailing edges of the dream from reality. Tom stared at the crystal dome of Kithrop's night. His body was locked, legs pulled in, hands clutching opposite shoulders, as much from a rigor of exhaustion as from the cold. Slowly he got the muscles to loosen. Tendons popped and joints groaned as he learned all over again how to move. The volcano to the north had died down to only a feeble red glow. There were long, ragged openings in the clouds overhead. Tom watched pinpoints of light in the sky. He thought about stars. Astronomy was his mental focus. Red means cool, he pondered. That red one there might be a small nearby ancient or a distant giant already in its death throes. And that bright one over there could be a blue supergiant, very rare. Was there one in this area of space? He ought to remember. Tom blinked. The blue star was moving. He watched it drift across the starfield until it intercepted another bright pinpoint, this one a brilliant green. There was a flash as the two tiny lights met. When the blue spark moved on, the green was no more. Now what were the chances I'd witness that? How likely to be looking at just the right place at the right time? The battle must still be pretty hot and heavy up there. It isn't over yet. Tom tried to rise, but his body sagged back against the bed of vines. Okay, try again. He rolled over onto one elbow, paused to marshal his strength, then pushed upright. Kithrop's small, dim moons were absent, but there was enough starlight to make out the eerie weedscape. Water sluiced through the shifting morass. There were croaking and slithering sounds. Once he heard a tiny scream that choked off. Some small prey suddenly dying, he supposed. He was thankful for the obstinacy that had brought him to this modest height. Even 2 meters made a difference. He couldn't have survived a night down in that loathsome mess. He turned stiffly and began groping through his meager supplies on the crude sledge. First priority was to get warm. He pulled the top piece of his wetsuit from the jumbled pile and gingerly slid into it. Tom knew he should give some attention to his wounds, but they could wait just a little longer. So could a full meal. He had salvaged enough stores for a few of those. Munching on a food bar and taking sparing sips from a canteen, Tom appraised his small pile of equipment. At the moment, what mattered were his 3 psi bombs. He looked up at the sky. Except for a faint purple haze near 1 bright star, there were no more signs of the battle. Yet that 1 glimpse had been enough. Tom already knew which bomb to set off. Jillian had spent a few hours with the NIS machine before leaving Streaker to meet him at Toshio's Island. She had connected the Timbrimi device to the Thenanin microbranch library he had salvaged. Then she and the NIS had worked out the proper signals to load into the bombs. The most important was the Thenanin distress call. Ifni's fickle luck permitting, it would let Tom perform the crucial experiment to find out if the plan would work. All of the work Suessi and Tisht and the others had put into the Trojan seahorse would come to naught if Thenanin were not amongst those left in the war. What use would it be for Streaker to slip inside a hollowed-out Thenanin hulk, to rise into space in disguise, if all the combatants would shoot anyway at a remnant of a faction which had already lost? Tom picked up one psi-bomb. It was spherical and rested in his hand like an orb. At the top was a safety switch and timer. Jillian had carefully labeled each bomb on a strip of tape. On this one she had added a flowing signature and a small heart with an arrow through it. Tom smiled and brought the bomb to his lips. He had felt guilty of machismo, insisting on being the one to come here while she remained behind. Now he knew he had been right. Tough and competent as Jillian was, she wasn't as good a pilot as he, and probably would have died in the crash. She certainly wouldn't have had the physical strength to haul the sledge this far. L, he thought. I'm glad because she's safe with friends who'll protect her. That's reason enough. She may be able to lick 10 Blenchuk cave lizards with one hand tied, but she's my lady, and I'll not let harm come near her if I can help it. The complaining volcano thundered and rumbled, reminding him ironically of Mount Diana, when he had last seen it, spilling molten magma down the towering, shelving slope of Aphrodite Terra, that continent whose flanks were washed by the searing, bone-dry ghost of a primeval Dead Sea. Under the sulphurous clouds of Venus, those lava flickerings had illuminated another long night of all-too-well-remembered pain, only this nearby Kithrupan fumarole would have barely glimmered on mighty Diana's distant fiery shoulders. Anyway, on Venus, night has no end. There, too, he had lain amid rubble, half broken, wondering whether he was going to live or die. Through his pitted helmet visor, he had watched infrared trails through the choking atmosphere left by a slow rain of faraway descending comets, hurtling ice balls whose targeted plummet seemed aimed just over the curved horizon, beyond the reach of sight or sound. He had been young and naive then, or else he never would have trusted a stranger's word that the hired dirigiplane was fully checked out for a quick dash across Ella's burning sands, a stranger who, Tom later recalled, had never once looked him in the eye while filling out the rental forms. First impressions can be wrong, he contemplated, after barely surviving the crash. But when in doubt, trust what your senses tell you. Then, too, the overwhelming sensation had been of frustration and failure. With information in his pouch, the Venus terraforming project might yet manage to hold on to its alien advisors, galactics from the Institute for Progress, who were due to pull out the very next day, dismissing as quixotic the quaint human dream of awakening seas already dead for 3 billion years. With their knowledge and technological aid, miracles might yet happen if only the advisors could be persuaded to stay. If the data reached them in time... He shuddered, remembering that earlier trial. The similarities were deceiving. On Venus, help had been just an hour away, and the issues, while serious, weren't as horrific. And on Venus the problem was to keep from burning up. A chill breeze penetrated his damp clothes, sending his teeth briefly chattering. Still, from now on, maybe I'd better make a point of staying away from volcanoes. Tom washed down the last of the protein bar. He hefted the bomb and considered strategy. His original plan had been to land near the volcano, wait until the glider had recharged for launching, then plant the bomb and take flight before it went off. He could have ridden thermals from the volcano to a good altitude and found another island from which to watch the results of his experiment. Lacking another island, he still could have gone far enough, landed in the ocean, and used his telescope to watch from there. It was a nice plan, foiled by a raging storm and an unexpected jungle of mad vines. His telescope had joined the metal detritus at the bottom of Kithrop's World Sea, along with most of the wreckage of his solar plane. Tom rose carefully to his feet. Food and warmth made it merely an exercise in controlled agony. Rummaging through his few belongings, he tore a long, narrow strip of cloth from the tattered ruins of his sleeping bag. The swatch of tough, insew silk seemed adequate. The psi bomb felt heavy and substantial in his hand. It was hard to imagine the globe stuffed with powerful illusions, a super-potent counterfeit, ready to burst free on command. He set the timer for 2 hours and thumbed the safety release, arming the thing. He laid it carefully into his makeshift sling. Tom knew he was being dramatic. Distance wouldn't help all that much. Sensors all over the Kithrop system would light up when it went off. He might as well set it off at his feet. Still, one never knew. Might as well toss it as far away as he could. He let the sling sway a few times to get the feel of it. Then he began swinging it. Slowly at first, he built up momentum while a strange feeling of well-being spread outward from his chest into his arms and legs. Fatigue seemed to fall away. He started to sing. Oh, Daddy was a caveman. He fought in skins, no shirts. He dreamed of lights up in the sky while scratching in the dirt. Your ETs and your stars. Oh, Daddy the bold fighter slew his cousins, fourth and third. He dreamed of peace eternally and died speared to the earth. You ETs and your stars. Oh, Daddy was a lover, and yet he beat his wife. He dreamed, longing for sanity, regretting all his life. You ETs and your stars. Yes, and Daddy was a leader. He dreamed, yet still told lies. He got the frightened masses to put missiles in the skies. You ETs and your stars. My daddy was unlearned, but ever on he tried. He hated his damned ignorance and struggled with his pride. He stepped up on a bootstrap, then, and upon nothing, cried. That tragic orphan willed to me a mind and heart, then died. So scorn me as a wolfling, sneer at my orphan scars. But tell me, boys, what's your excuse? You ETs and your stars. You ETs and your stars. Tom's shoulders flexed as he took a step. His arm snapped straight, and he released the sling. The bomb sailed high into the night, whirling like a top. The spinning sphere shone briefly, still climbing, sparkling, until it disappeared from sight. He listened, but never heard it land. Tom stood still for a while, breathing deeply. Well, he thought at last, that built an appetite. I have 2 hours to eat, tend my wounds, and prepare a shelter. Any time I get after that, O Lord, will be accepted with humble gratitude. He laid the ragged strip of cloth over his shoulder and turned to prepare himself a meal by starlight. Part 5. Concussion. In a world older and more complex than ours, they move finished and complete, gifted with extensions of the senses we have lost or never attained, living by voices we shall never hear. They are other nations caught with ourselves in the net of life and time. Henry Bateson. Chapter 46. Sound. It was evening, and the Kikwi were leaving for their hunting grounds. Sout heard them squeaking excitedly as they gathered in a clearing west of the toppled drill tree. The hunters passed not far from the pool on their way to a rock chimney on the southern slope of the island, chittering and puffing their lung sacs in pomp. Sout listened until the abos were gone. Then he sank a meter below the surface and blew depressed bubbles. Nothing was going right. Denny had changed, and he didn't like it. Instead of her usual delightful skittishness, she virtually ignored him. Worse, she had listened to two of his best limericks and answered seriously, completely missing the delicious double entendres. In spite of the importance of her studies of the Kikwi, Dakota Jim had ordered her also to analyze the drill tree system for Charles Dart. Twice, she had gone into the water to collect samples from below the metal mound. She had ignored Sout's nuzzling advances, or even more disturbing, petted him absently in return. Sout realized that for all of his previous efforts to break her down, he hadn't really wanted her to change, at least not this way. He drifted unhappily until a tether attached to one of the sleds brought him up short, reminding him of the worst affront of all. His new assignment kept him linked to this electrical obscenity, chafed and cramped in a tiny pool while his real work was out on the open sea with the pre-sentients. When Jillian and Kipiru left, he had assumed their absence would free him to do pretty much what he wanted. Ha! No sooner had the pilot and physician left than did Toshio step in and assume command. I should have been able to talk rings around him. How in the five galaxies did the boy manage to get the upper hand? But here he was, stuck monitoring a damned robot for a pompous, egocentric chimpanzee who cared only about rocks. The dumb little robot didn't even have a brain one could talk to. You don't have conversations with microprocessors. You tell them what to do, then helplessly watch the disaster when they take you literally. His harness gave off a chime. It was time to check on the probe. Sout clucked a sarcastic response. Yes, in duty, lord and master, metal moron and disaster. Beep again. I'll work faster. Sout brought his left eye even with the sled's screen. He sent a pulse code to the robot, and a stream of data returned. The bot had finally digested the most recent rock sample. He ordered the probe's small memory emptied into the sled's databanks. Toshio had run him through the drill until Sout could control the bot almost unconsciously. He made it anchor one end of a monofilament line to the rough rock, then lower itself another 50 meters. The old explanation for the hole beneath the metal mound had been discarded. The drill tree couldn't have needed to dig a tunnel a kilometer deep in search of nutrients. It shouldn't have been able to pierce the crust that far. The mass of the drill root was clearly too great to have been rotated by the modest tree that once stood atop the mound. The amount of material excavated wouldn't fit atop 10 metal mounds. It was found as sediment all around the high ridge on which the mound sat. To Sout, these mysteries weren't enticing. They only proved once again that the universe was weird, and that maybe humans and dolphins and chimps ought to wait a while before challenging its deeper puzzles. The robot finished its descent. Sout made it reach out and seize the cavity wall with diamond-tipped claws, then retract its tether from above. Down in stages it would go. For this little machine, there would be no rising. Sout felt that way himself sometimes, especially since coming to Kithrop. He didn't really expect ever to leave this deadly world. Fortunately, the probe sampling routine was fairly automatic once triggered. Even Charles Dart should have little excuse to complain. Unless... Sout cursed. There it was again. The static that had plagued the probe since it had passed the half-kilometer mark. Toshio and Kipiru had worked on it and couldn't find the problem. The crackling was unlike any static Stout had ever heard. Not that he was an expert on static. It had a syncopation of sorts. Not all that unpleasant to listen to, actually. Stout had heard that some people liked to listen to white noise. Certainly nothing was more undemanding. The clock on his harness ticked away. Stout listened to the static and thought about perversities, about love and loneliness. I swim circles like the others and learn, sadly, I am sightlessly sighing alone. Slowly, Stout realized he had adopted the rhythm of the noise below. He shook his head, but when he listened again, it was still there. A song. It was a song. Stout concentrated. It was like trying to follow all parts of a six-part fugue at the same time, the patterns interleaved with an incredible complexity. No wonder they had all thought it noise. Even he had barely caught on. His harness timer chimed, but Stout didn't notice. He was too busy listening to the planet sing to him. Chapter 47 Streaker. Moki and Haoki had both volunteered for guard duty, but for different reasons. Both enjoyed getting out of the ship for a change, and neither dolphin particularly minded having to stay plugged into a sled for hours at a stretch in the dark, silent waters outside the ship. But beyond that, they differed. Haoki was there because he felt it was a necessary job. Moki, on the other hand, hoped guard duty would give him a chance to kill something. I wish Takata Jim sent me after Aki instead of Katha John, Moki rasped. I could have tracked the smart ass just as well. Moki's sled rested about 20 yards from Haoki's on the high underwater bluff overlooking the ship. Arc lamps still shone on Streaker's hull, but the area was deserted now, off limits to all but those few cleared by the vice captain. Moki looked at Haoki through the flexible bubble dome of his sled. Haoki was silent as usual. He had ignored Moki's comment completely. Arrogant spawn of a stink squid. Haoki was another tersiops smart aleck like Crydike, and that stuck-up little midship fin, Aki. Moki made a small sound sculpture in his mind. It was an image of ramming and tearing. Once he had put Crydike in the role of the victim. The captain, who had so often caught him gold-bricking and embarrassed him by correcting his Anglic grammar, had finally got his just deserts. Moki was glad. But now he needed another fantasy target. It was no fun to imagine ripping into nobody in particular. The Calafian, Aki, served well when it was discovered that the young middy had betrayed the vice-captain. Moki had hoped to be the one sent after Aki, but Takata Jim had ordered Katha John out instead, explaining that the purpose was to bring Aki back for discipline, not to commit murder. The giant had seemed oblivious to such nice distinctions when he departed equipped with a powerful laser rifle. Perhaps Takata Jim had less than perfect control over Katha John and had sent him away for his own safety. From the gleam in Katha John's eye, Moki did not envy the Calafian when the youth was found. Let Katha John have, Aki. One small pleasure lost didn't take much away from Moki's overall joy. It was good to be big for a change. On his off-duty time, everybody got out of Moki's way, as if he was a pod leader. Already, he had his eye on one or two of those sexy little females in Mackinese sickbay. Some of the younger males looked good, too. Moki wasn't particular. They would all come around soon enough, when they saw the way the current pulled. He briefly resisted an urge, but couldn't help himself. He let out a short skirr of triumph in a forbidden form. Glory is glory. Biting is and glory. Females submit. A new bull is. He saw Hauki react at last. The other guard jerked slightly and raised his head to regard Moki. He was silent, though, as Moki met his eye defiantly. Moki sent a focused beam of sonar directly at Hauki to show he was listening to him, too. Arrogant stink squid. Hauki would get his, too, after Takata Jim had locked his jaws on the situation, and the men of Earth would never disapprove, because Big Human Metz was at Takata Jim's side, agreeing with everything. Moki let out another squeal of primal, tasting the forbidden primitiveness with delight. It pulled at something deep inside him. Each taste brought on further hunger for it. Let Hauki click in disgust. Moki dared even the Galactics to come and try to interfere with him and his new captain. Hauki bore Moki's bestial squawking stoically, but it reminded him that he had joined up with a gang of cretins and misfits. Unfortunately, the cretins and misfits were right, and the brightest of Streaker's crew were caught up in a disastrous misadventure. Hauki was desperately sad over the crippling of Krydike. The captain had obviously been among the best the breed could produce, but the accident had made possible a quiet and perfectly legal change in policy, and he couldn't regret that. Takata Jim at least recognized the foolishness of pursuing the desperate Trojan seahorse scheme. Even a Streaker could be moved silently to the Thenanin wreck, and if Tisht's crew had miraculously set things up so Streaker could wear the Hulk as a gigantic disguise, and actually take off under those conditions, what would that win them? Even if Thomas Orley had reported that Thenanin were still in the battle in space, there remained the question of fooling those Thenanin into coming to rescue a supposed lost battleship and escorting it to the rear. A dubious chance. The question was moot. Orley was obviously dead. There had been no word for days, and now the gamble had turned into a desperate wish. Why not just give the thrice-damned Galactics what they want? Why this romantic nonsense of saving the data for the Terrigan's Council? What do we care about a bunch of dangerous, long-lost hulks, anyway? It's obviously no business of ours if the Galactics want to fight over the derelict fleet. Even the Kithrop Aboriginals weren't worth dying for. It all seemed plain to Hauki. It was also apparent to Takata Jim, whose intelligence Hauki respected. But if it was so obvious, why did people like Krydike and Orley and Hikahi disagree? Quandaries like this were the sort of thing that had kept Hauki a subsec in the engine room instead of trying for non-com or officer, as his test scores indicated. Moki blatted out another boast phrase in primal. He was even louder this time. The Stenos was trying to get a rise out of him. Hauki sighed. Many of the crew had begun behaving that way. Not quite as bad as Moki, but bad enough. And it wasn't just Stenos, either. As morale dissolved, so did the motivation to maintain Kanink, to keep up the daily fight against the animal side that always wanted out. One would hardly have been able to predict weeks ago who later turned out to be the most susceptible. Of course, all the best crew fen were away, with Suesi and Hikahi. Fortunately, Hauki thought. He dwelt on the irony of good going to bad, and right coming out of wrong. At least Takata Jim seemed to understand how he felt, and didn't hold it against him. The vice-captain had taken Hauki's support with gratitude. He heard Moki's tail thrash, but before the angry little Stenos could voice another taunt, both of their sled speakers came to life. Hauki and Moki, Comstock Finn Huerta Pete calling. Acknowledge. The call was from the ship's comm and detection operator. The fact that the jobs had been combined showed just how bad things were.
Roger, Aoki here. Moki's indisposed at the moment.
What's up?
He heard Moki choke a protest, but it was clear the Finn would be a while reformatting his mind for Anglic.
We have a sonic bogey to the east, Aoki. Sounds like a sled. If hostile, destroy. If it's someone from the island, they must be turned back. If they refuse, shoot to disable the sled.
Understood. Aoki and Moki on our way.
All right, Gabby, he told the speech-tied Moki. Aoki gave his partner a long, narrow grin.
Let's check it out and watch that trigger. We're only enforcing a quarantine. We don't shoot at crewmates unless we absolutely have to.
With a neural impulse, he turned his sled motor on. Without looking back, he lifted off from the muddy rise, then accelerated slowly to the east.
Moki watched Aoki head out before turning his sled to follow.
Tempted, tempted. Tempted, Moki, is temptation. Delicious, is.
The sleds dropped, one after another, into the gloom. On a passive sonar screen, there were small blurry dots that drifted slowly past the shadow of the seamount, then disappeared behind it. Kipiru opened his harness's right claw and dropped the portable listening unit. It tumbled down to the soft ooze. He turned to Jillian.
Done and gone, they chase our shadows. They'll not like to catch false prey.
Jillian had expected guards. Several kilometers back, they had left the sled on delayed automatic and swam off to the north and west. By the time the sled started up again, they had circled to within a few hundred yards of the outlock. Jillian touched Kipiru's flank. The sensitive hide trembled under her hand.
You remember the plan, Kipiru?
Need you ask? Jillian raised an eyebrow in surprise. A triple upsweep trill and a wavering interrogative click. That was an unusually brief and straightforward reply for trinary. Kipiru was capable of more subtlety than she had thought.
Of course not, dear bow wave rider. I apologize. I'll do my part and not worry for a moment about you doing yours.
Kipiru looked at her as if wishing he didn't have to wear a breather, as if he wanted to speak to her in her native language. Jillian felt some of this in a gentle telepathic touch. She hugged his smooth gray torso.
You take care, Kipiru. Remember that you're admired and loved. Very much so.
The pilot tossed his head. To swimming or battle. To warning or rescue. To earning your trust. They dropped over the edge of the bluff and swam quickly for the ship's outer lock. Chapter 48 Takata Jim. It was impossible to rest. Takata Jim envied humans the total unconsciousness they called sleep. When a man lay down for the night, his awareness of the world disappeared, and the nerves to his muscles deactivated. If he did dream, he usually didn't have to participate physically. Even a neo-dolphin couldn't just turn himself off that way. One or the other hemisphere of the brain was always on sentry duty to control his breathing. Sleep, for a Finn, was both a milder and a far more serious thing. He knocked about the captain's stateroom, wishing he could go back to his own smaller cabin. But symbolism was important to the crew he had inherited. His followers needed more than the logic of legality to confirm his command. They needed to see him as the new bull, and that meant living in the style of the former herd leader. He took a long breath at the surface and emitted clicks to illuminate the room in sound images. Brydaki certainly had eclectic tastes. If he knew what sort of things the former captain had owned, which couldn't stand wetness,
and had therefore been stowed away before Streaker landed on Kithrum. The collection that remained was striking. Works by artists of a dozen sentient races lay sealed behind glass cases. Sound-stroke photos of strange worlds and weird aberrant stars adorned the walls. Brightike's music system was impressive. He had recordings by the thousands, songs and eerie things that made Takata Jim's spine crawl when he played them. The collection of whale ballads was valuable, and a large fraction appeared to have been collected personally. By the desk comm, there was a photo of Crydike with the officers of the James Cook. Captain Helene Alvarez herself had signed it. The famous explorer had her arm over her dolphin exec's broad, smooth back as she and Crydike mugged for the camera. Takata Jim had served on important ships, cargo vessels supplying the Atlas and Calafia colonies, but he had never been on missions like those of the legendary Cook. He had never seen such sights, nor heard such sounds. Until the shallow cluster, until they found dead ships the size of moons. He thrashed his tail in frustration. His flukes struck the ceiling painfully. His breath came heavily. It didn't matter. Nothing that he had done would matter if he succeeded. If he got Streaker away from Kithrop with her crew alive, if he did that, he would have a photo of his own, and the arm on his back would be that of the President of the Confederacy of Earth. A shimmering collection of tiny motes began to collect to his right. The sparkles coalesced into a holographic image a few inches from his eye. "Yes, what is it?" he snapped. An agitated dolphin, harness arms flexing and unflexing, nodded nervously. It was the ship's purser, Suppa.
"Sir, something strange has happened. We weren't sure we should wake you, but..."
Takata Jim found the Finn's underwater anglic almost indecipherable. Suppa's upper register warbled uncontrollably.
"Calm down and talk slowly," he commanded sharply. The Finn flinched, but made an effort to obey.
I was in the outlock. I heard someone say there was an alert. Quirk of Pete sent Haoki and Moki after sled sounds.
Why wasn't I informed?"
Suppa recoiled in dismay. For a moment, he appeared too frightened to speak. Takata Jim sighed and kept his voice calm.
"Never mind. Not your fault. Go on."
Visibly relieved, Suppa continued.
"A few minutes later, the light on the personnel outlock came on. Wadasetti went over, and I paid no heed. But when Life Cleaner and Wormhole Pilot entered..."
Takata Jim spumed. Only dire need to hear Suppa's story without delay prevented him from crashing about the room in frustration.
"Tried to stop them, as you ordered, but... Wadasetti and Hiska were doing backflips of joy and dashed about fetching for them both."
"Where are they now?" Takata Jim demanded.
"Baskin entered the main bay with Wadasetti. Hiska is off, spreading rumors throughout the ship. Kipuro took a sled and breathers and is gone."
"Gone where?"
"Back out,"
Suppa wailed. His command of Anglic was rapidly dissolving. Takata Jim took advantage of what composure the purser had left.
"Have Herkapeed awaken Dr. Metz. Have Metz meet me at sick bay with three guards. You are to go to the dry wheel dressing room with Sawtooth, and let no one enter. Understood?"
Suppa nodded vigorously, and his image vanished. Takata Jim prayed that Herkapeed would have the sense to recall Moki and Haoki and send them after Kipiru. Together, between Haoki's brains and Moki's feral ruthlessness, they might be able to cut the pilot off before he reached the Thenanin wreck. "Why isn't Katha John back yet? I chose him to go after that Midi in order to get him out of the ship for a while. I was afraid he was becoming dangerous even to me. I wanted some time to organize without him around, but now... the Baskin woman's returned sooner than I expected.
Maybe I should have kept Cathar John around. The giant's talents might be useful about now.
Takata Jim whistled the door open and swam out into the hall. He faced a confrontation he had hoped to put off for at least another 40 hours, if not indefinitely. Should I have seen to Crydike before this? It would have been easy. A power failure in his gravity tank, a switched catheter. Metz would not approve, but there was already much Metz did not know. Much that Takata Jim wished he didn't know. He swam hard for the intra-hull lift. Maybe I won't need Cathar John in order to deal with Jillian Baskin, he thought. After all, what can one human female do?
Chapter 49 The Psi-Bomb.
The mound of partly dried weeds formed a dome on the sea of vines. Tom had propped up a low roof using salvaged bits of strutting from his sledge, making a rude cave. He sat at the entrance, waiting in the pre-dawn dimness, and munched one of his scarce food bars. His wounds were cleaned as well as possible, and coated with hardening dabs of medicinal foam. With food in his stomach and some of the pain put down, he almost felt human again. He examined his small osmotic still. The upper part, a clear bag with a filtered spout at one end, held a thick layer of salt water and sludge. Below the filter, one of his canteens sat almost filled. Tom looked at his watch. Only 5 minutes remained. There was no time to dip for another load of scummy water to feed the still. He wouldn't even be able to clean the filters before the bomb went off. He picked up the canteen, screwed its cap tight, and slipped it into a thigh pouch. Then he popped the filter out of its frame and shook most of the sludge out, before folding it tightly and tucking it under his belt. The filter probably didn't take all the dissolved metal salts out of the water. It hadn't been designed with Kithrop in mind. Nonetheless, the little package was probably his most valuable possession. 3 minutes, the glowing numbers on his watch told him. Tom looked up at the sky. There was a vague brightening in the east, and the stars were starting to fade. It would be a clear morning, and therefore bitterly cold. He shivered and zipped the wetsuit tight. He pulled in his knees. Again, Venus came to mind, perhaps because then, too, his fate and all he cared about had hung upon sending a message. Only there, it had been for succor. Moreover, his enemies had been few and furtive, while all around him friendly humans and aliens had roamed the steaming skies, searching for a slender clue he had only to provide. This time matters were reversed. Friends were the scarce commodity, while his signal would be a shout, a scream directed at countless foes. Enemies who, at best, would willingly rack his body and strain his brain pan for what it contained. Yet he must strive to bring them here, down here, almost to this very spot. How do I keep getting into jams like this? 1 minute. When it came, it would be like the loudest sound he had ever heard, like the brightest light. There would be no keeping it out. He wanted to cover his ears and eyes as if against a real explosion. Instead, he stared at a point on the horizon and counted, pacing each breath. Deliberately, he let himself slide into a trance. 7, 8, 9, 10. A lightness filled his chest. The feeling spread outward, numbing and soothing. Light from the few stars in the west diffracted spiderweb rays through his barely separated eyelashes as he awaited a soundless explosion.
Sout, I said I'm ready to take over now.
Sout squirmed and looked up at Toshio.
Just another few minutes, okay? I'm listening to something.
Toshio frowned. This was not what he had expected from Sout. He had come to relieve the dolphin linguist early because Sout hated working with the robot probe.
What's going on, Tosh?
Denny sat up in her sleeping bag, rubbing her eyes, peering in the pre-dawn dark.
I offered to take over the robot so Stout wouldn't have to deal with Charlie when he calls, but he refuses to let go.
Denny shrugged.
Then I'd say that's his business. What do you care, anyway?
Toshio felt a sharp answer rise to his lips, but he kept them locked and turned away. He would ignore Denny until she wakened fully and decided to behave civilly.
This ends side one of Cassette 7. Cassette 7, side 2.
Denny had surprised him after Jillian and Kipiru left by taking his new command without complaint. For the last 2 days, she hadn't seemed much interested in anything but her microscopes and samples, ignoring even Stout's desultory sexual innuendo, answering questions in monosyllables. Toshio knelt by the comm unit attached by cable to Stout's sled. He tapped out a query on the monitor and frowned at the result.
"Stout," he said severely, "get over here."
"Emma says sec."
The dolphin sounded distracted. Toshio pursed his lips.
"Now you will to hear in gather, or shortly cease all listening further."
He heard Denny gasp behind him, though she probably didn't understand the trinary burst in detail. Toshio felt justified. This was a test. He wasn't as subtle as Jillian Baskin, but he had to get obedience or be useless as an officer. Stout stared up at him, blinking dazedly. Then the fin sighed and moved over to the side of the pool.
"Stout, you haven't taken any geological readings in 4 hours, yet in that time you've dropped the probe 200 meters. What's got into you?"
The Stenos rolled from side to side uncertainly. Finally, he spoke softly.
"I'm getting a song."
The last word faded before Toshio could be sure of it. "You're getting a what?"
"A song."
Toshio lifted his hands and dropped them to his sides. "He's finally cracked. First Denny, now Stout. I've been left in charge of 2 mental cases. He sensed Denny approach the pool.
"Listen, Stout," Toshio said. "Dr. Dart will be calling soon. What do you think he's going to say when..."
"I'll take care of Charlie when he calls,"
Denny said quietly.
"You?"
Denny had spent the last 40 hours cursing over the drill tree problem she had been assigned at Takata Jim's order and Charles Dart's request. It had almost completely superseded her work with the Kikui. Toshio couldn't imagine her wanting to talk with the chimpanzee.
"Yes, me. What I have to tell may make him forget all about the robot, so... you just lay off Stout. If he says he heard singing, well, maybe he's heard singing."
Toshio stared at her, then shrugged.
"Fine. My job is to protect these two, not correct their scientific blunders. I just hope Jillian straightens things out back at the ship, so I can report what's going on here."
Denny knelt down by the water to talk to Stout. He spoke slowly and earnestly, patient, with the anglic slowness he suffered after his long seance with the robot. Denny wanted to dive to look at the core of the metal mound. Stout agreed to accompany her if she would wait until he transcribed some more of his music. Denny assented, apparently completely unafraid of going into the water with Stout. Toshio sat down and waited for the inevitable buzz of the comm line from the ship. People were changing overnight, and he hadn't the slightest idea why. His eyes felt scratchy. Toshio rubbed them, but that didn't seem to help. He blinked and tried to look at Denny and Stout. The difficulty he was having focusing only seemed to be getting worse. A haziness began to spread between himself and the pool. Suddenly he felt a sense of dread expectancy. Pulsing, it seemed to migrate from the back of his head to a place between his shoulder blades. He brought his hands to his ears.
"Denny? Stout? Do you..."
He shouted the last words, but could barely hear his own voice. The others looked up,
Denny rose and took a step toward him, concern on her face. Then her eyes opened in wide surprise. Toshio saw a blur of movement. Then there were Kikui in the forest, charging them through the bushes. Toshio tried to draw his needler, knowing it was already too late. The aboriginals were already upon them, waving their short arms and screaming in tiny, high-pitched voices. Three plowed into him, and two toppled Denny. He struggled and fell beneath them, fighting to keep their slashing claws away from his face, while the grating noise erupted in his brain. Then, in an instant, the Kikui were gone. Amidst the grinding roar in his head, Toshio forced himself to turn over and look up. Denny tossed back and forth across the ground, moaning, clutching at her ears. Toshio feared she had been wounded by Kikui claws, but when she rolled his way, he saw only shallow cuts. With both shaking hands, he drew his needler. The few Kikui in sight weren't heading this way, but squealing as they rushed the pool and dove in. "It's not their doing," he realized dimly. At least, he recognized the sound of 1,000 fingernails scraping across a blackboard. "A psi attack. We have to hide. Water might cushion the assault. We should dive in like the Abos did." His head roared as he crawled toward the pool. Then he stopped. "I can't drag Denny in there, and we can't put on our breathing gear while shaking like this." He reversed direction until he reached a poolside tree. He sat with his back against the bowl, and he tried to concentrate in spite of the crashing in his brain. "Remember what Mr. Orley taught you, Mitty. Think about your mind and go within. See the enemy's illusions. Listen lightly to his lies. Use the yin and the yang, the twin salvations, logic to pierce Mara's veil, and faith to sustain." Denny moaned and rolled in the dust a few meters away. Toshio laid the needler on his lap to have it ready when the enemy came. He called to Denny, shouting over the screaming noise. "Denny! Listen to your heartbeat! Listen to each breath! They're real sounds! This isn't!" He saw her turn slightly toward his voice, agony in her eyes, as she pressed white, bloodless hands over her ears. The shrieking intensified. "Count your heartbeats, Denny! They're like the ocean, like the surf! Denny!" he shouted. "Have you ever heard any sound that can overcome the surf? Can anything or anybody scream loud enough to keep the tide from laughing back?" She stared at him, trying. He could see her inhaling deeply, mouthing slowly as she counted. "Yes! Count, Denny! Breaths and heartbeats! Is there any sound the tide of your heartbeat can't laugh at?" He locked onto his eyes as he anchored himself to hers. Slowly, as the howling within his head reached its crescendo, Toshio saw her nod and give a faint, grateful smile. Thout felt it too. Even as the psychic wave rolled over him, the pool was suddenly afroth with panicky Kikui. Thout was inundated by a babble of noise from all around and within. It was worse than being blinded by a searchlight. He wanted to dive away from the cacophony. Biting back panic, he forced himself to separate the noise into parts. Denny and Toshio seemed in worse shape than he. Perhaps they were more sensitive to the assault. There would be no help from them. The Kikui were in terror, squalling as they crashed into the pool. "Flee! Flight from the sad great things! Somebody help the great sad hurt things!" Out of the mouths of babes. When he concentrated, the psi attack did feel like a call for help. It hurt like the hell of the deeps, but he faced it and tried to pin it down. He thought he was making progress. Certainly he was coping. When still another voice joined in, this one over his neural link, the song from below that he had spent all night unable to decipher,
had awakened. From the bowels of Kithrop, it bellowed. Its simplicity commanded understanding. Who calls? Who dares bother? Thout moaned as he tore the robot link free. Three screaming noises, all at different levels of mind, were quite enough. Any more and he would go insane. Buolt of the Thenanin was afraid, though an officer in the service of the great ghosts thought nothing of death or of living enemies. The shuttle cycled through the lock of his flagship, Kriegsfire. The giant doors, comfortingly massive and enduring, swung shut behind them. The shuttle pilot plotted a course to the Tandu flagship. Tandu. Buolt flexed his ridge crest as a display of confidence. He would lose heat from the sale of nerves and blood vessels in the frigid atmosphere of the Tandu ship, but it was absolutely necessary to maintain appearances. It might have been slightly less distasteful to make an alliance with the Soro instead. At least the Soro were more Thenanoid than the anthropod Tandu, and lived at a decent temperature. Also, the Soro's clients were interesting folk, the sort Buolt's people might have liked to uplift themselves. Better for them if we had, he thought, for we are kind patrons. If the leathern Soro were meddlesome and callous, the spindly Tandu were horrifying beings. Their clients were weird creatures that set off twitches at the base of Buolt's tail when he thought of them. Buolt grimaced in disgust. Politics made for strange gene transfers. The Soro were now strongest among the survivors. The Thenanin were weakest of the major powers. Although the Tandu philosophy was the most repulsive of those in opposition to the Abdicator Creed, they were now all that stood in the way of a Soro triumph. The Thenanin must ally with them for now. Should the Tandu seem about to prevail, there would be another chance to switch sides. It had happened a number of times already, and would happen again. Buolt steeled himself for the meeting ahead. He was determined not to let show any of his dread of stepping aboard a Tandu ship. The Tandu didn't seem to care what chances they took with their crazy, poorly understood probability drive. The insane reality manipulations of their Apesiarch clients let them move about more quickly than their opponents, but sometimes the resulting alterations of space-time swallowed whole groups of ships, impartially snatching the Tandu and their enemies from the universe forever. It was madness. Just let them not use their perverted drives while I am aboard, Buolt's organ of prayer subvocalized. Let us make our battle plans and be done. The Tandu ships came into sight, crazy, stilt-like structures that disdained armor for wild speed and power. Of course, even these unusual shapes were mere variations of ancient library designs. The Tandu were daring, but they did not add to their crimes the gaucherie of originality. Earthlings were in many ways more unconventional than the Tandu. Their sloppy gimmickry was a vulgar habit that came from a poor upbringing. Buolt wondered what the dolphins were doing right now. Pity the poor creatures if the Tandu or Soro got hold of them. Even these primitive sea mammals, clients of a coarse and hairy wolfling race, deserved to be protected, if possible. Of course, they were priorities. Pitiable or not, they mustn't be allowed to hoard the data they held. It must be shared with the Abdicator faction, or with no one. Buolt noticed that his finger claws had unsheathed in his agitation. He pulled them back and cultivated serenity as the shuttle drew near the Tandu squadron. Buolt's musing was split by a sudden chill that made his crest tremble. A disturbance on a psi band. Operator, he snapped, contact the flagship. See if they verify that call.
Immediately, General Protector.
Buolt controlled his excitement. The psychic energies he felt could be a ruse. Still, they felt right. They bore the image of the Krondos fire, which none of them had hoped to see again. Determination filled him. In the negotiations ahead, he would ask one more favor. The Tandu must provide one added cooperation in exchange for the help of the Thenanin.
"Confirmed, sir. It is battleship Krondos fire,"
the pilot said, his voice raspy with emotion. Buolt's crest stood erect in acknowledgement. He stared ahead at the looming metal mantis shapes, feeling himself for the confrontation, the negotiations, and the waiting. Bei Chuhuan was listening to whale songs, rare and expensive copies which had cost her a month's pay some time ago, when her detectors picked up the beacon. Reluctantly, she put down her headphones and noted the direction and intensity. There were so many signals, bombs and blasts and traps. Then one of the little Wazoon pointed out to her that this particular beacon emanated from the water world itself. They groomed her whiskers and considered.
"I believe this will change things, my pretty little ones. Shall we leave this belt of unborn rubble in space and move toward the action? Is it time to let the Earthlings know that someone is out here who is a friend?"
The Wazoon chittered back that policy was her business. According to Union rules, they were spies, not strategists. They approved of their sarcasm. It was very tasty.
"Very well," she said. "Let us try to move closer."
Hikahi hurriedly queried the skiff's battle computer.
"It's a psi weapon of some sort," she announced via hydrophone to the crew working in the alien wreck.
Her Anglic was calm and precise, accentuated with the cool overtones of Kanik.
"I detect no other signs of attack, so I believe we're feeling a fringe of the space battle. We felt others before, if not this intense. We're deep underwater, partly shielded from psi waves. Grit your teeth, Streakers. Try to ignore it. Go about your duties in tropic clear logic."
He switched off the speakers. Hikahi knew Tish was even now moving among the workers out there, joking and keeping morale high. The psi noise was like a nagging itch, but an itch with a weird rhythm. It pulsed as if in some code she couldn't quite get her jaws around. She looked at Hannes Tuessi, who sat on a wall rail nearby, looking very tired. He had been about to turn in for a few hours' sleep, but the psionic assault apparently affected him worse than it did the dolphins. He had compared it to fingernails scratching on a blackboard.
"I can think of two possibilities, Hikahi. One would be very good news, the other's about as bad as could be."
She nodded her sleek head.
"We've repeatedly rechecked our circuits, sent three couriers back with messages, and yet there's only silence from the ship. I must assume the worst."
"That Streaker's been taken." Tuessi closed his eyes.
"Yes. This psi havoc comes from somewhere on the surface of the planet. The Galactics may even now be fighting over her, or what's left of her."
Hikahi decided.
"I'm returning to Streaker in this boat. I'll delay until you've sealed quarters for the work crew inside the hulk. You need power from the skiff to recharge the Thenanin accumulators."
Tuessi nodded. Hikahi was clearly anxious to depart as soon as possible.
"I'll go outside and help, then."
"You just got off duty. I cannot permit it."
Tuessi shook his head.
"Look, Hikahi, when we've got that refuge inside the battleship set up, we can pump in filtered fizzy water for the Fen, and they'll be able to rest properly. The wreck is well shielded from this psychic screeching, too, and most important, I'll have a room of my own, one that's dry, without a crowd of squeaking, practical-joking children goosing me from behind whenever I turn the other way."
His eyes were gently ironic. Hikahi's jaw made a gentle curve.
"Wait a minute, then, maker of wonderful toys. I'll come out and join you. Work will distract us from the scratching of E.T. fingernails.
The Sorrow, Krat, felt no grating tremors. Her ship was girded against psychic annoyances. She first learned of the disturbance from her staff. She took the data scroll from the Pila Culibera with mild interest. They had detected many such signals in the course of the battle, but none yet had emanated from the planet. Only a few skirmishes had taken the war down to Kithrop itself. Normally, she would have simply ordered a homing torpedo dispatched and forgotten the matter. The expected Tandu-Thenanin alliance against the Sorrow was forming up near the gas giant world, and she had plans to make. But something about this signal intrigued her.
"Determine the exact origin of this signal on a planetary map," she told the Pila. "Include locations of all known landfalls by enemy ships."
"There would be dozens by now, and the positions very vague," the pill statistician barked. Its voice was high and sharp, its mouth popped open for each syllable, and hairy cilia waved above its small black eyes. Krat did not dignify it with a look.
"When the Sorrow intervened to end Pelan indenture to the Kisa," she hissed, "it was not to make you grand elders. Am I to be questioned like a human who pampers his chimpanzee?"
Culibera shivered and bowed quickly. The stocky Pila scuttled away to its data center. Krat purred happily. Yes, the Pila were so close to perfect. Arrogant and domineering with their own clients and neighbors, they scurried to serve the Sorrow's every whim. How wonderful it was to be a grand elder. She owed the humans something at that. In a few centuries, they had almost replaced the Timbrimi as the boogeymen to use on recalcitrant clients. They symbolized all that was wrong with uplift liberalism. When terror was finally humbled and humans were adopted into a proper client status, some other bad example would have to serve instead. Krat opened a private communication line. The display lit up with the image of the Sorrow Prittle, the young commander of one of the ships in her flotilla.
"Yes, Fleet Mother," Prittle bowed slowly and shallowly. "I listen."
Krat's tongues flickered at the young female's insolence.
"Ship number 16 was slow in the last skirmish, Prittle." "One opinion."
Prittle examined her mating cloth. She cleaned it in front of the screen, an indelicacy designed to show indifference. Younger females seldom understood that a real insult should be subtle and require time for the victim to discover it. Krat decided she would teach Prittle this lesson.
"You need a rest for repairs. In the next battle, ship number 16 would be next to useless. There is, however, a way in which she might win honor, and perhaps the prey as well."
Prittle looked up, her interest piqued.
"Yes, Fleet Mother? We have picked up a call that pretends to be one thing, perhaps an enemy pleading for succor. I suspect it may be something else."
The flavor of intrigue obviously tempted Prittle.
"I choose to listen, Group Mother."
Krat sighed at the predictability. She knew the younger captains secretly believed all the legends about Krat's hunches. She had known Prittle would come around. "You have much yet to learn," she thought, "before you will pull me down and take my place, Prittle. Many learning scars shall mar that young hide first. I will enjoy teaching you until that day, my daughter." Jillian and McKinney looked up as Takata Jim and Dr. Ignacio Metz entered sickbay, accompanied by three stocky, war-harnessed, hard-faced Xenos. They squealed indecipherable indignation and moved to interpose himself. McKinney's assistants chittered behind the ship's surgeon. Jillian met McKinney's eye. It had come, the confrontation. Now they would see if McKinney was only imagining things. Jillian still held out a hope
that Takata Jim and Metz had compelling reasons for their actions, and that Krydike's injury was truly an accident. McKinney had already made up her mind. Aki, the young midship Finn from Calathea, had still not returned. The doctor glared at Takata Jim as she would look at a tiger shark. The expression on the male dolphin's face did little to belie the image. Jillian had a secret weapon, but she had sworn never to use it except in the direst emergency. Let them act first, she thought. Let them show their cards before we pull that last ace of trumps. The first stages might be a little dangerous. She had only had time to make a brief call to the NIS machine from her office before hurrying to sickbay. Her position here might be difficult if she had miscalculated the degree of atavism loose on Streaker. Maybe she should have kept Kipiru by her side.
Dr. Baskin!
Ignacio Metz didn't swim very close before grabbing a wall rail and letting an armed Stenos pass before him.
It's good to see you again, but why didn't you announce yourself?
A gross violation of security rules, Doctor, Takata Jim added. So that's the way of it, Jillian thought. And they might try to make that stick long enough to get me into a cell. Why, I came for the ship's council meeting, Gentle Finn and Mel. I got a message from Dr. McKinney calling me back for it. Sorry if your bridge crew fouled up my reply. I hear they're mostly new and inexperienced up there. Takata Jim frowned. It was even possible she had sent such a call, which had been lost in the confusion on the bridge. McKinney's message was also against orders, and your return was contrary to my specific instructions. Jillian put on an expression of bewilderment. Wasn't she simply passing on your call for a ship's council? The rules are clear. You must call a meeting within 24 hours of the death or disability of the captain.
Preparations were underway, but in an emergency, the acting captain can dispense with the advice of the council. When faced with clear disobedience of orders, I am within rights to...
Jillian tensed herself. Her preparations would do no good if Takata Jim were irrational. She might have to make a break by vaulting over the row of auto docks to the parapet above. Her office would be steps away.
To order that you be detained for a hearing to be held at some time after the emergency.
Jillian took in the stances of the guard fen. Would they really be willing to harm a human being? She read their expressions and decided they just might be. Her mouth felt dry, but she didn't let it show.
You misread your legal status, Lieutenant, she replied carefully. I think very few of the Fen aboard would be surprised to learn that...
The words stopped in her throat. Jillian felt a chill in her spine as the air itself seemed to waver and throb around her. Then, as she grabbed a rail for support, a deep growling sound began to emanate from inside her head. The others stared at her, confused by her behavior. Then they began to feel it, too. Takata Jim whirled and shouted,
"Thy weapon! McKinney, give me a link to the bridge. We are under attack."
The dolphin physician moved aside, amazed by Takata Jim's quickness as he rushed past. Jillian pressed her hands over her ears and saw Metz doing the same, as the grating noise grew louder. The security guards were in disarray, fluting disconsolately, with boat-like pupils wide in fear. Should I make my break now? Jillian tried to think. But if this is an attack, we'll have to drop our quarrels and join forces.
Incompetence! Takata Jim shouted at the comm. What do you mean, only 1,000 miles away? Pinpoint it! Why won't the active sensors work?
Wait! Jillian cried. She clapped her hands together. Through a haze of building emotion, she started to laugh. Takata Jim continued to bark rapidly at the bridge crew,
but everyone else turned to look at her in surprise. Jillian laughed. She slapped the water, pounded on the nearest auto dock, grabbed Watasetti around the dolphin's quivering flank. Even Takata Jim stopped then, captivated by her apparently psychotic fit of joy. He stared, oblivious to frantic twitters from the bridge.
"Tom!" she cried out loud. "I told you you couldn't die! Damn it, I love you, you son of a... Oh, if I had gone, I would have been home by now!"
The Finns stared at her, eyes opening still wider, as they began to realize what she was talking about. She laughed, tears running down her face.
"Tom," she said softly, "I told you you couldn't die."
And blindly, she hugged close whatever was nearest to her. Sounds came to Krydike as he drifted in weightlessness. It was like listening to Beethoven, or like trying actually to understand a humpback whale. Somebody had left the audio link on in case he made any more sounds. No one had considered that the circuit went both ways. Words penetrated the gravity tank from the outer room. They were tantalizing, like those ghosts of meaning in a great symphony, hinting that the composer had caught a glimpse of something notes could only vaguely convey, and words could never approach. Takata Jim spluttered and mumbled. The threatening tone was clear, so was the cautious clarity of Jillian Baskin's voice. If only he could understand the words, but Anglet was lost to him. Krydike knew his ship was in peril, and there was nothing he could do to help. The old gods weren't through with him and would not let him move. They had much more to show him before he was ready to serve their purposes. He had become resigned to periodic episodes of terror, like diving to do battle with a great octopus, then rising for a rest before going back down to the chaos once again. When they came to pull him down, he would once more be caught in the maelstrom of idea glyphs, of throbbing dreams, which hammered away at his engineer's mind with insistent impressions of otherness. The assault never would have been possible without the destruction of his speech centers. Krydike grieved over the loss of words. He listened to the talk sounds from the outer world, concentrating as hard as he could on the eerie, musical familiarity. It wasn't all gone, he decided after a while. He could recognize a few words here and there, simple ones, mostly the names of objects or people or simple actions associated with them. That much his distant ancestors could do. But he couldn't remember the words more than three or four deep, so it was impossible to follow a conversation. He might laboriously decipher a sentence, only to forget it completely when he worked on the next one. It was agonizingly difficult, and at last he made himself cease the vain effort. "That's not the way," he concluded. Instead, he should try for the gestalt, he told himself. Use the tricks the old gods had been using on him. Encompass. Absorb. Like trying to feel what Beethoven felt by submerging into the mystery of the violin concerto. Murmuring sounds of angry sophists squawked from the speaker. The noises bounced around the chamber and scattered like bitter droplets. After the terrible beauty of down, he felt repelled. He forced himself to listen, to seek a way, some humble way to help Streaker and his crew. Need swelled within him as he concentrated. He sought a center, a focus in the chaotic sounds. Rancor turbid in the riptide, ignoring sharks, internecine struggle, inviting sharks, foolish opportunism. Against his will, he felt himself begin to click aloud. He tried to stop, knowing where it would lead, but the clicks emerged involuntarily from his brow, soon joined by a series of low moans. The sounds of the argument in sickbay drifted away,
as his own soft singing wove a thicker and thicker web around him. The humming, crackling echoes caused the walls to fade as a new reality took shape all around. A dark presence slowly grew next to him. Without words, he told it to go away. "No, we are back. You have more to learn. For all I know, you're a delirium of mine. None of you ever make a sound of your own. You always speak in reflections from my own sonar. Have your echoes ever been so complex? Who knows what my unconscious could do? In my memory are more strange sounds than any other living cetacean has heard. I've been where living clouds whistled to tame hurricanes. I've heard the doom booms of black holes and listened to the songs of stars." "All the more reason you are the one we want, the one we need." "I am needed here." "Indeed. Come," cried Ikey. The old god, Kifkri, moved closer. Its sonically translucent form glistened. Its sharp teeth flashed. Pigment or not, the great thing began to move, carrying him along, as before, helpless to resist. Down. Then, just as resignation washed over, cried Ikey, he heard a sound. Miraculously, it wasn't one of his own making, diffracted against the insane dream. It came from somewhere else, powerful and urgent. "Pay no heed. Come." Krydike's mind leaped after it as if it were a school of mullet, even as the noise swelled to deafening volume. "You are sensitized. You have psi you had not known before. You know not yet its use. Relinquish quick rewards. Come the hard way." Krydike laughed and opened himself to the noise from the outside. It crashed in, dissolving the shining blackness of the old god into sonic specks that shimmered and then slowly disappeared. "That way is not for you, Krydike." Then the great-browed god was gone. Krydike laughed at his release from the cruel illusion, grateful for the new sound that had freed him. But the noise kept growing. Victory went to panic as it swelled and became a pressure within his head, pushing against the walls of his skull, hammering urgently to get out. The world became a whirling, groaning, alien cry for help. Krydike let out a warbling whistle of despair as he tried to ride the crashing tide. Chapter 50. Streaker. The waves of pseudo sound were fading at last.
"Krydike!"
McKinney cried and swam to the captain's tank. The others turned also, just noticing the injured dolphin's distress.
"What's the matter with him?"
Jillian swam up next to McKinney. She could see the captain struggle feebly, giving off a slowly diminishing series of low moans.
"I don't know. No one was watching him as the psi bomb hit its peak. Just now I saw he was disturbed."
The large, dark gray form within the tank seemed calmer now. The muscles along Krydike's back twitched slowly as he let out a low, warbling cry. Ignacio Metz swam up alongside Jillian.
Jillian, he began, "I want you to know that I'm very glad Tom is alive, although this tardiness bodes poorly. I'd still stake my life that this Trojan seahorse plan of his is ill-conceived."
"We'll have to discuss that at ship's council then, won't we, Dr. Metz?" she said coolly. Metz cleared his throat.
"I'm not sure the acting captain will permit..."
He subsided under her gaze and looked away. She glanced at Takata Jim. If he did anything rash, it could be the last straw that broke Streaker's morale.
Jillian had to convince Takata Jim that he would lose if he contested with her, and he had to be offered a way out, or there might still be civil war aboard the ship. Takata Jim looked back at her with a mixture of pure hostility and calculation. She saw the sound, sensitive tip of his jaw swing toward each of the Fen in turn, gauging their reaction. The news that Thomas Orley still lived would go through the ship like a clarion. Already one of the armed Stenos guards, presumably carefully picked by the vice-captain, looked mutinously jubilant and chattered, hopefully, with Watasetti. "I've got to act fast," Jillian realized. "He's desperate." He swam toward Takata Jim, smiling. He backed away, a loyal Stenos glaring at her from his side. Jillian spoke softly, so the others could not hear. "Don't even think it, Takata Jim. The Fen aboard this ship have Tom Orley fresh on their minds now. If you thought you could harm me before this, even you know better now." Takata Jim's eyes widened, and Jillian knew she had struck on target, capitalizing on the legend of her psi ability. "Besides, I'm going to stick close to Ignacio Met. He's gullible, but if he witnesses me being harmed, you'll lose him. You need a token man, don't you? Without at least one, even your Stenos will melt away." Takata Jim clapped his jaw loudly. "Don't try to bully me. I don't have to harm you. I am the legal authority on this ship. I can have you confined to quarters." Jillian looked at her fingernails. "Are you so sure?" "You would incite the crew to disobey the legal ship's master?" Takata Jim sounded genuinely shocked. He must know that many, perhaps most of the Tersiops would follow her, whatever the law said. But that would be mutiny and tear the crew apart. "I have the law on my side," he hissed. Jillian sighed. The hand must be played out for all the damage this would do if the dolphins of Earth found out. He whispered the two words she had not wanted to utter.
"Secret orders," he said.
Takata Jim stared at her, then let out a keening cry. He stood on his tail and did a backflip, while his guard blinked in confusion. Jillian turned and saw Metz and Watasetti staring at them.
"I don't believe you,"
Takata Jim spluttered, spraying water in all directions.
"On Earth, we were promised. Streaker is our ship."
Jillian shrugged. "Ask your bridge crew if the battle controls work," she offered. "Have someone try to leave through the outlock. Try to open the door to the armory." Takata Jim whirled and sped to a comm screen at the far end of the room. His guard stared at Jillian momentarily, then followed. His look conveyed a sense of betrayal. Not all of the crew would feel that way, Jillian knew. Most would probably be delighted, but deep inside an implication would settle. One of the main purposes of Streaker's mission, to build in the Neo Fen a sense of independence and self-confidence, had been compromised. "Did I have any other choice? Is there anything else I might have tried first?" She shook her head, wishing Tom were here. Tom might have settled everything with one sarcastic little ditty in trinary that put everybody to shame. "Oh, Tom," she thought, "I should have gone instead of you."
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 7, Startide Rising, Cassette 8.
"Jillian!" McAnee's flukes pounded the water, and her harness whirred. With one metal arm, she pointed up at the wounded dolphin floating in the gravity tank. Crydike was looking back at her.
"Joshua H. Barb, but you said his cortex was fried,"
Matt stared. An expression of profound concentration bore down on Crydike's features. He breathed heavily, then gave voice to a desperate cry.
"Out! It's not possible," McAnee sighed.
His speech centers?
Krydike frowned in effort.
Out! Krydike! Swim! Krydike!
It was trinary baby talk, but with a queer tone to it, and the dark eyes burned with intelligence. Jillian's telepathic sense throbbed.
Out!
He whirled about in the tank and slammed his powerful flukes against the window with a loud boom. He repeated the Anglic word. The falling tone slope was like a phrase in primal.
Out! Help him out! McAnee commanded her assistants. Gently, quickly!
Takata Jim was heading back from his comm screen at high speed, wrath on his face. But he stopped abruptly at the gravity tank and stared at the bright eye of the captain. It was the last straw. He rolled back and forth, as if unable to decide on appropriate body language. Takata Jim turned to Jillian.
What I've done was in what I believe to be the best interest of the ship, crew, and mission. I could make a very good case on Earth.
Jillian shrugged. Let's hope you get the chance. Takata Jim laughed dryly.
Very well. We'll hold the charade ship's council. I'll call it for 1 hour from now. But let me warn you, don't push too far, Dr. Baskin. I have powers still. We must find a compromise. Try to pillory me, and you will divide the ship.
And then I will fight you, he added, low. Jillian nodded. She had achieved what she had to. Even if Takata Jim had done the worst things McAnee suspected of him, there was no proof, and it was a matter of compromise or lose the ship to civil war. The first officer had to be offered an out.
I'll remember, Takata Jim. In 1 hour, then, I'll be there.
Takata Jim swirled about to leave, followed by his two loyal security guards. Jillian saw Ignacio Met staring after the Dolphin lieutenant.
You lost control, didn't you?
She asked dryly as she swam past him. The geneticist's head jerked.
What, Jillian? What do you mean?
But his face betrayed him. Like many others, Metz tended to overestimate her psychic powers. Now he must be wondering if she had read his mind.
Never mind.
Jillian's smile was narrow. Let's go and witness this miracle. She swam to where McAnee waited anxiously for the emerging Krydike. Metz looked after her uncertainly before following. Chapter 51 Thomas Orley. With trembling hands, he pulled vines away from the cave entrance. He crept out of his shelter and blinked at the hazy morning. A thick layer of low clouds had gathered. There were no alien ships yet, and that was just as well. He had feared they would arrive while he was helpless, struggling against the effects of the psi bomb. It hadn't been fun. In the first few minutes, the psychic blasts had beaten away at his hypnotic defenses, cresting over them and drenching his brain in alien howling. For 2 hours, it had felt like eternity, he had wrestled with crazy images, pulsing, nerve-evoked lights and sounds. Tom still shook with reaction. I sure hope there are still Thenanin out there and that they fall for it. It had better have been worth it. According to Jillian, the NIST machine had been confident it had found the right codes in the library taken from the Thenanin wreck. If there were still Thenanin in the system, they should try to answer. The bomb must have been detectable for millions of miles in all directions. He dragged a handful of muck out of the gap in the weeds and flung it aside. Scummy seawater welled up almost to the surface of the hole. Another gap probably lay only a few meters beyond the next hummock. The weedscape flexed and breathed incessantly. but Tom wanted a water entrance near at hand. He scooped away the slime as best he could, then wiped his hands and settled down to scan the sky from his shelter. On his lap, he arranged his remaining psi bombs. Fortunately, these wouldn't pack the wallop of the Thenan in distress call. They were simply pre-recorded message casts, designed to carry a brief code, a few thousand kilometers. He had only recovered 3 of the message globes from the glider wreck, though he could only broadcast a narrow range of facts. Depending on which bomb he set off, Jillian and Krydike would know what kind of aliens had come to investigate the distress call. Of course, something might happen that didn't fit into any of the scenarios they had discussed. Then he would have to decide whether to broadcast an ambiguous message or do nothing and wait. Maybe it would have been better to bring a radio, but a warship in the vicinity could pinpoint a transmission instantly and blast his position before he spoke a few words. A message bomb could do its work in a second or so and would be much harder to locate. Tom thought about Streaker. Everything desirable was there. Food, sleep, hot showers, his woman. He smiled at the way the priorities had spilled out. Ah, well, Jill would understand. Streaker might have to abandon him if his experiment led to a brief chance to blast away from Kithrop. It would not be a worthless way to die. He wasn't afraid of dying, only of having not done all he could, and not properly spitting in the eye of death when it came for him. That final gesture was important. Another image came to him, far more unpleasant. Streaker already captured, the space battle already over, all of his efforts useless. Tom shuddered. It was better to imagine a sacrifice being for something. A stiff breeze kept the clouds moving. They merged and separated in thick, wet drifts. Tom shaded his eyes against the glare to the east. About a radian south of the haze-shrouded morning sun, he thought he saw a motion in the sky. He huddled deeper into his makeshift cave. Out of one of the eastern cloud drifts, a dark object slowly descended. Swirling vapor momentarily obscured its shape and size as it hung high above the sea of weeds. A faint drumming sound reached Tom. He squinted from his hiding place, wishing for his lost binoculars. Then the mists parted briefly, and he saw the hovering spaceship clearly. It looked like some monstrous dragonfly, sharply tapered and wickedly dangerous. Few races delved so deeply into the library for weird designs as did the idiosyncratic, ruthless Tandu. Wild protrusions extended from the narrow hull in all directions, a Tandu hallmark. At one end, however, a blunt, wedge-shaped appendage clashed with the overall impression of careless, cruel delicacy. It didn't seem to fit into the overall design. Before he could get a better view, the clouds came together, concealing the floating cruiser from sight. The faint hum of powerful engines grew slowly louder, however. Tom scratched an itchy 5-day growth of beard. The Tandu were bad news. If they were the only ones to show themselves, he would have to set off message bomb number 3, tell Streaker to lock up and get ready for a death fight. This was an enemy with whom mankind had never been able to negotiate. In skirmishes on the galactic marshes, Terran ships had seldom conquered Tandu vessels, even with the odds in their favor. And when there were no witnesses around, the Tandu loved to pick fights. Standing orders were to avoid them at all costs, until such time as Timbrimey advisors could teach human crews the rare knack of beating these masters of the sneak and strike. If the Tandu were the only ones to appear, it also meant he had likely seen his last sunrise, for in setting off a message bomb, he'd almost certainly given away his position. The Tandu had clients who could sigh, sniff even a thought if they once caught the mental scent.
Tell you what, Ifni, he thought. You sent someone else into this confrontation. I won't insist it be Thenanin. A Jofer fighting planetoid will suffice.
Mix things up here, and I promise to say 5 sutras, 10 Hail Marys, and a Kiddush when I get home, okay? I'll even dump some credits in a slot machine if you like.
He envisioned a Timbrimy human Cynthian battle fleet erupting out of the clouds, blasting the Tandu to fragments and sweeping the sky clear of fanatics. It was a lovely image, although he could think of a dozen reasons why it wasn't likely. For one thing, the Cynthians, friendly as they were, wouldn't intervene unless it was a sure thing. The Timbrimy, for that matter, would probably help Earth defend herself, but wouldn't stick their lovely humanoid necks too far out for a bunch of lost wolflings.
Okay, Ifni, you lady of luck and chance. He fingered bomb number 3. I'll settle for a single beat-up old Thenanin cruiser.
Infinity gave him no immediate answer. He hadn't expected one. The thrumming seemed to pass right over his head. His hackles rose as the ship's strong field region swept the area. Its shields screeched at his modest psi sense. Then the crawling rumble began slowly to recede to his left. Tom looked west. The ragged clouds separated just long enough to display the Tandu cruiser. A light destroyer, he now saw, and not really a battleship, only a couple of miles away. As he watched, the blunt appendage detached from the mothership and began to drift slowly to the south. Tom frowned. That thing didn't look like the Tandu scout ships he was familiar with. It was a totally different design, stout and stolid, like... The haze came together again, frustratingly, covering the two ships. Their muttering growl accompanied the muted grumblings of the nearby volcano. Suddenly, 3 brilliant streams of green light speared down from the clouds where Tom had last seen the Tandu ship, to hit the sea with flashing incandescence. There came a peal of supersonic thunder. First he thought the Tandu were blasting the surface below, but a crackling bright explosion in the clouds showed that the destroyer itself was at the receiving end. Something high above the cloud deck was shooting at the Tandu. He was too busy snatching up gear to waste time in exultation. Tom kept his head averted, and so was spared blindness as the destroyer began firing actinic beams of antimatter at its assailant. Waves of heat scorched the back of his head and his left arm as he stuffed the psi bombs under his waistband and snapped on a breather mask. The beams of annihilation made streaks of solar heat across the sky. Tom grabbed his pack and dove into the hole he had earlier cleared in the thickly woven weeds. The thunder suddenly muted as he splashed through a jungle of dangling vines. Straight shafts of flickering battle light speared into the gloom. Tom found he was automatically holding his breath. That didn't make much sense. The mask would not allow much oxygen to escape, but it would pass carbon dioxide. He started inhaling as he grabbed a strong root for an anchor, but soon found he was laboring for breath. With all the vegetation around, he had expected the oxygen content to be high, but the tiny indicator on the rim of his mask told that the opposite was true. The water was depleted compared to the normally rich brine of Kithrip Sea. The waving gill fins of the mask were picking up only a third as much oxygen as he would need to maintain himself, even if he stayed perfectly still. In just a few minutes, he would start to get dizzy. Not long thereafter, he would pass out. A battle roar penetrated the weed cover in a series of dull detonations. Shafts of brilliance shot into the gloom through openings in the leafy roof, one right in front of Orly. Even indirectly, the light hurt his eyes.
He saw fronds just above the waterline, which had recently survived ashfall from a volcano, curl from the heat, turn brown, and fall away. So much for the rest of my supplies. So much for coming up for air. He wrapped his legs around the thick root and shrugged out of his backpack, rummaging through the satchel for something to improvise. In the sharp shadows, he negotiated the contents mostly by touch. The inertial tracker Jillian had given him, a pouch of food bars, 2 canteens of fresh water, explosive slivers for his needler, a toolkit. The air meter was turning an ominous orange. Tom wedged the pack between his knees and tore open the toolkit. He seized a small roll of 8-gauge rubber tubing. Purple blobs flickered on the edge of his field of vision as he used his sheath knife to cut a length of narrow hose. He crammed one end through the mask's chow lock. The seal held, but the contents of the tube sprayed at his mouth, making him gag and cough. There was no time for finesse. He shimmied up the root to a point within reach of the hole in the weeds. Tom pinched the tube below the other end, but bitter, oily water streamed from the tube as he straightened the coil. The mask's demon lock would purge the fluid if too much didn't flood in. He averted his face, but swallowed a little anyway. It tasted foul. Tom reached out and pushed the tube above the surface of the narrow pool, where the battle flashes sent shafts of light into the depths. He sucked hard at the hose, spitting out slime and a sharp metallic tang, desperately trying to clear it. One of the searing blasts flashed closer than ever, scalding his fingers below the waterline. He fought the instinct to shout or pull away from the pain. Consciousness began to slip, and with it, the will to hold his left hand into the searing heat. He drew hard, and at last was rewarded with a thin stream of dank air. Tom sucked frantically. The hot, steamy air tasted of smoke, but it nourished. He exhaled into the mask, trusting it to hold the hard-won oxygen. The aching in his lungs subsided, and the agony of his hand took the fore. Just as he thought he couldn't hold it out there anymore, the burning heat from above subsided, fading to a dull, flickering glow in the sky. A few meters away was another gap in the weeds, where he might be able to prop the tube between 2 thick roots without exposing himself. Tom took a few more breaths, then pinched the tube shut. But before he could prepare any further, a sharp blue light suddenly filled the water, brighter than ever, casting stark, blinding shadows everywhere. There was a tremendous detonation. Then the sea began tossing him about like a rag doll. Something huge had struck the ocean and set it bucking. His anchor root came free of its mooring, and he fell into a maelstrom of flailing vines. The swell tore the backpack from him. He grabbed after it and caught the end of one strap, but something struck him in the back of the head, knocking him dizzy. The pack was snatched away into the noise and flashing shadows. Tom curled into a ball, his forearms holding the rim of his mask against the whipping vines. There had been another maelstrom of sand and grinding, blazing wind. The air of Venus, far thicker than water, had torn at his frail suit and helmet, its fierce grip on his chest making each breath precious. Before very long, he had ceased walking, stumbling, crawling through the drifts. Finally, crouching in the lee of a jagged basalt tooth, he had waited to die. An hour or